Welcome to The Lobbying Show, the show about the people in government relations, how they got into it, and what their jobs entail, what works and what doesn't. I am the host, Jim O'Brien. John Raffaele, that's who you're going to hear from today. What a great interview, great guy, Southern guy, self-made, has been ranked one of the top 25 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. They're a top 10 firm, the Capital Council. We sat down in his conference room down in Washington, D.C., and I really enjoyed sitting down with John. He gave an overview of how he approaches lobbying with the three or four P's that that he thinks are wise in approaching problems. And John is just a great guy. He got his start working for Senator Benson as his tax counsel and international trade person. So clearly he's intelligent. He spent 4 years with Senator Benson, who is known as the gentleman of the Senate, and went on from there. So I really enjoyed sitting down with John, and I hope you enjoy the interview as much as I did. Well, actually, why don't we go back and start with John Raffaele, how you got involved in politics, before we talk about the current day.
The short version is, I always loved politics, ordered the Congress.
For our listeners who don't know, where are you from?
Oh, Texas.
If they can't tell, they'll be able to tell soon, but tell them where you're from.
A little town called Texarkana, border of Texas and Arkansas. I grew up on the Texas side of Texarkana.
Okay.
Always loved politics, got interested in it when I was real young. So I got my congressman to sign me up for the Congressional Record. I used to get that when I was a kid.
Really? How old were you?
Oh, gosh, I got involved in the 64 LBJ campaign.
Wow.
That got me turned on to it. I was 12.
And you had your congressman send you the Congressional Record?
Yeah. Back then, the congressman could send like 25 copies of the Congressional Record to constituents who wanted it. There probably weren't 24 others. And my mother didn't want them either after they started stacking up. We hadn't had a big garage, I'd have been in trouble. but I used to think it was kind of, I paged for the Texas State Legislature a few years later. I was interested in, so.
There cannot be many 12-year-olds who had requested the copy of the Congressional Record. And did you read it?
Occasionally, I looked through for Mr. Patman stuff. I was a big fan of
Ray. And that was the congressman?
My hometown congressman.
Okay.
And that's what interested me, is watching him.
Yep.
Get his weekly newsletter on the things he was doing.
And yep.
He literally had, a weekly newsletter.
Okay.
Because when I came up here.
And he would mail it to your house?
Yeah.
Yep.
Or 73, yep. And in 73, I came up here as a college student. I came up to intern for Mr. Patman. I had been a page in the Texas State Legislature. Still loved politics when I got to college.
Where'd you go to college?
University of Texas at that time.
Okay. Austin?
In Austin.
Yep.
And I was eager to come up here. And so I got lucky. My mother didn't know. Obviously, we knew the congressman. My mother worked with the congressman's son, Connor, in a real estate business. So my first experience with politics is that's how you get a job, is have relationships and connections. Mm-hmm. But that's how I got it. And so came up, worked for Mr. Patman, met a wonderful man that tutored me, mentored, etc. Author John Keefe, who was a professor at Catholic U, but also working up on the Hill.
Okay.
For the for Mr. Patman, writing a thing on the history of the Federal Reserve.
And what did he teach at CUA?
He was a well-known, well-respected law professor.
Okay.
But he didn't know much about accounting, and he was doing a thing on the Fed and bank failures and things, so they sent him I was an accounting undergrad student, so they said,
you got to go help him.
Go help him.
What was his last name again?
Keefe.
Keefe, okay. Arthur John Keefe, and he taught at the law school there at Catholic U?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Portrait hangs there. He was a very well-respected
guy
at Catholic. And he kind of convinced me that basically, being an accountant was like being a plumber or any other trade. I was wasting my college life, and you should have learned the arts. But I didn't, so I was a helpful plumber to him. But basically, he said, everybody has to go to law school or pick your trade. So, and his was law, so he He was kind enough to help me get into law school. And
Catholic or?
He actually, I went to, because I grew up in Texarkana.
Yep.
I could go to Arkansas as a resident student, so I went to the University of Arkansas Law School.
Okay.
And
you got the residential discount?
Yeah, I was a resident.
Okay.
Because in Texarkana, they
split yep.
the...
splits, yep.
Yeah. So there's a lot of kids that go by either one. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So you went back, went to law school.
Mm-hmm. Law school, then went to NYU because I wanted to be a tax attorney, accounting undergrad.
Got your LLM.
Got an LLM in tax. Got lucky enough to get a job clerking for the tax court. And at the tax court, during that time, because I spent time on the Hill,
yep.
when Mr. Benson, Senator Benson, was looking for a tax LA, I got a call from a friend I've worked with who was now with Benson, but had been with Mr. Patman.
Yep.
And she said, oh, you should interview for this. And I said, I'm not interested, but I wouldn't mind meeting Senator Benson. So.
But you didn't think you were interested in the job?
No. I was going to go back to Texarkana. Oh. There was not a tax lawyer in Texarkana who had an LLM in tax.
And so you were going to have the corner on the market there.
Well, certainly I'd have a leg up on
yep.
people who wanted to look at, had complicated tax situations or wanted to have somebody with a deeper knowledge of the tax laws.
Right.
I thought I'd have a good shot getting into a good firm and creating okay. a tax practice.
Yep.
And several have done it since I left, so I was right.
Right.
They just did it instead of me.
Right. So you used it as an opportunity to meet Senator Benson.
Yeah, and he offered me the job, and I thought, I'll do this for a couple of years.
Can't hurt.
No, why? And then I'll go to Texarkana, but it'd be fun. I loved working up on Capitol Hill. It's a great opportunity.
Yeah.
So, and Senator Benson was a very well-respected member of the United States Senate. He was a senior member of the committee. He was somebody who other members listened to.
Yep.
And he was a very thoughtful guy, so it was a great chance. So I took it, and after a few years of doing that, I found out people in Texarkana weren't willing to pay me nearly as much as the people in Washington were willing to pay me.
And you liked it here.
Was I going to tell you what the tax laws are, or was I going to work on the policy side of changing the tax laws? And having done the court where you interpret it, and the policy side where you create it, it's much more exciting, much more enjoyable work than dealing through one trans. How do you do a 1031 like-kind exchange if you got two pieces of property, one in Texas and one in Connecticut, and another piece of property with a little interest over here? Can that qualify? Those kind of
right.
technical questions. Or
right. So much funner to be on the policy.
Much more exciting, much more interesting to me. And public policy, really, and public service, watching people like Lloyd Benson or Bob Dole, or the people around him at that time, the quality of the members, made you feel like this is special. Not only are they entrusted with a certain power, but the people that have taken that on are really special people.
Yep.
So that was, I was blessed to get to see some really great legislators. Bob Dole was, or Howard Baker was running the Senate. Bob Dole was running the Finance Committee. It was different than it is today.
And how many years did you work for Senator Benson?
I guess it was 4 or 3. I'm having a hard time remembering.
3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And you were helping him on tax policy during that time?
Tax and Trade Council.
Wow.
Good times.
That must have been.
We did the 80. We did the 81 bill, which was the Reagan Act. Then we did the 82 tax increase, which at that time was the largest ever. But Dole had done the largest tax cut, the largest tax increase. But the country needed, because of the situation we were in economically and the deficit. And they were all true fiscal conservatives. They worried about deficits. Bob Dole and others worked to pass that. And we also, last time Social Security was addressed, was under those guys. They had the courage and willingness to take on hard issues. The last time we increased the highway, the gasoline tax, Bob Dole and Lloyd Benson and those guys, they had the guts to take on the issues that most members today will not accept without, checking the political winds. And nobody likes tax increases. And nobody wants to deal with cutting any kind of, entitlement
right.
program. So,
right. So, Bob, that's incredible. I said, that's incredible. They, that's right. And Bob Dole supported that and was the leader on that tax increase.
Yeah, he passed it. He got it done.
Yeah.
He was the chairman.
Yeah. So that must have been pretty intoxicating years. I mean, you were right there.
Yeah. Oh, it was a very good time. So that made it very special. And I thought, man, I want to be doing this forever. And so that's how you, but you got, you know.
You can't stay on the hill forever.
Can't stay on the hill forever.
So when you
left. Psychic income does not pay the grocer.
Right. And so how, so what was your first job when you left the hill?
Left the hill, started with a guy named Duffy Wall. It was just starting to practice. I'd known him. He'd been head of a corporate office and started one. I did that for a year. Then went out on my own. And was doing that. And then, I was on my own. Then did that for a couple of years. Then I got recruited into a big law firm.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine who convinced me, who joined Terry McAuliffe, he said, oh, you need to try the big firm thing. And I said, all right, I'll do it, but I don't think so. But it'd be great to have that big client base.
Yep.
Instead of having to go chase for clients every day.
Yep.
And
those clients need tax advice, which right. You could give them.
Right.
Right.
But I really wasn't looking to be a tax attorney at that point. I really wanted to do tax legislation.
Okay.
But in the big firm structure, it's not really designed to. The big firms have big clients, and if you've got a multi-million-dollar client that wants time with chairman of the finance committee and chairman of the ways and means committee and wants legislative work done, you know, you're expected to do it and do it on an hourly basis.
Yep.
That doesn't really work. I mean, getting a half hour with the chairman of the ways and means committee or knowing how to put something together, law firms leverage bodies. They want a senior partner, junior partner, and a middle partner, and then 50 associates working on a case. And all those hours add up into a big client. Lobbying is not about leveraging bodies. It's about leveraging your knowledge and skill on how to do it,
yep.
What to do, and when to do it.
Yep.
And, you know, and who to approach about accomplishing it.
Yep.
So that's all inside one person's head. And it might be two or three people on your team or whatever who have knowledge in that area.
Yep.
But, you know, it's not about billable hours.
Right.
But you try to structure any relationship with a client. Almost all lobbying work is retainer work. And that's because it's not about the hours. But what you're trying to do is figure out a way to cover your cost of operation.
Right.
And the only way you can really do that because you spend a lot of time is not billable in a normal sense.
Right. Building in the relationship sense, building that relationship so that when you have to go see the chairman, who you can't go see, you know, every week, he'll take the meeting and you know when to take the meeting or when to ask for the meeting and when not to. But you're right, you spend a lot of time building that skill set and that relationship so that when the time comes, you know how and when to do it.
Right. You know, I used to joke at the law firm, they would want meetings with certain members, and I'd say, okay, but, you know, you're right. You can only go ask people to meet with you so many times. I've got lots of people asking them to meet with them.
Right.
And you got to know whether what you're going to ask them is of interest to them and would they care about it, why they should be interested in this issue, and all those kinds of questions. But I used to jokingly say, no problem. You know, the first hour is $240,000, and after that, all the other hours are free. But I want a $20,000 a month retainer for 12 months. Because I don't want short-term clients. We only have an occasional problem.
Right. Right.
I'm only going to get so.
Right.
I got a little bit higher hourly rate than you have.
Right.
And the other partners go, you can't be serious. It kind of amounts to that.
Yeah.
I mean, do I want your clients or my clients? Because my clients will pay that away.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, your description about the law firm.
That's why the law firm didn't work for me.
Got it. Well, I've never heard it described that way, but that's exactly right. That's a very good description.
That's what makes them profitable. I don't mean to be ugly about
it. No, it's a different business.
Yeah, they have a different business model.
it's a different business. It is.
So that's when I started focusing on the traditional lobbying model. Something in between being a one-man band and being a law firm.
Yep.
Even though most of our competitors are law firms, or a lot of them. The top firms in the city with the largest buildings.
Yep.
Law firms. You know, law firms. They're Akin Gump, Brownstein, Patton Boggs, now Squire Boggs.
Yep.
Holland and Knight.
Yep.
Covington.
Yep.
So forth. All of them are, a lot of them are traditional law firms. Or have a legal side, even Williams and Jensen.
Yeah. And are you practicing any law today, per se? Just lobbying. Yeah. And so after, then that morphed into the Washington group. You were talking about McAuliffe, Kelly, Terry, Raffaelli. Yeah. Was Kelly the person that recruited you? Is that who you were referring to?
No, recruited me.
When you said someone said, why don't you come to the bigger firm, was that?
Oh, actually, it was a friend of mine who was working with Terry.
Okay.
Who had been at Chuck Manat's firm. And I talked him into trying the smaller thing.
Uh-huh.
And he thought having that platform, because I was solo on, would be a better thing for me. And his name was Tim Furlong. I don't know if you ever knew Tim.
No.
Sweetheart of a guy. He was one of Benson's first LAs.
Okay.
Not Benson Tax, but he was his LA.
Okay.
And Manat Phelps is a big firm. So anyway, I did it. It didn't fit. Tim unfortunately died. He was one of the early victims of AIDS before they were really making any progress on it.
Mm.
And so he died fairly young in 90. You know, he was young in 88.
Wow.
But anyway, when he passed away, I had gotten to know Terry McAuliffe through Terry rented space for me when I was soloing on Capitol Hill.
Okay.
Because I was across the street from the DCCC and he wanted an office. So I had gotten to know Terry through that, and then Tim joined him. And McAuliffe and I were friends, so Terry asked me to join him. The Kelly was Peter Kelly out in California, who was chair of the Democratic Party of California.
Okay.
So we kind of figured Terry was originally from New York and did the fundraising thing. Kelly, California, me from Texas, three great pools to go searching for clients.
Three big states.
Big states with big companies and opportunities. So
yep.
That was part of it. Terry didn't do lobbying. I did the lobbying business, and Terry did the political stuff.
Yeah.
And, and that was a great opportunity for me again.
Yeah.
And so McAuliffe, Kelly, and Raffaelli became a problem. Terry got too high profile. And then he left us after the Clinton reelect.
To go to the DNC?
I eventually became chair of the DNC, but he went and did some business deals and other things. And so the Republicans had taken over the House.
Oh, right.
So McAuliffe, Kelly, and Raffaelli were Democrat. And one of
them doesn't work.
Chair of a Democratic Party in California.
Right.
So, and we had Republicans in the firm. So to protect the innocent, as I say, we went generic and started the Washington Group.
So that morphed into the Washington Group.
It was very successful, bipartisan shop, did well.
Did you bring Republicans in at that time, or you already had them in shop?
We had them.
Okay.
We had them at the time.
Yep.
So, McAuliffe, Kelly, Raffaelli eventually became
the Washington,
Group. And then the Washington Group got sold to Omnicom.
Right.
In 2001.
Okay.
To Ketchum Public Relations, which is part of Omnicom.
Yep.
Publicly traded company. That worked out great for everybody. I thought it was good for me. And enjoyed it, stayed past my buyout. But at some point, they start running your shop, particularly after the buyout. And, when you've owned it and run it, and then other people are telling you how to do it.
Being an employee doesn't really work.
And I wasn't enjoying it as much. And so I saw an opportunity. And I thought, I'm just going to go back to doing what I like doing, which is tax.
Yeah.
And go back to being, keep it simple and do my own thing.
Yeah.
And so I told Omnicom I was leaving like 6 months before the elections in 08.
Okay.
And in November of 08, Congress flipped. the Democrat.
Yeah.
Or I guess 06, rather. This was 06.
Okay.
6 months before the 06 election.
Okay.
Democrats took over the House. My flavor was back in when you know, it was the flavor of the month.
Yep, you're back in.
Yeah. So I got a bunch of, in that process, I talked to two or three other people between November and January, because I had a 6 months, I had to give them 6 months notice. So I gave them notice in July. In January, we started Capital Council.
So you start with four or five people here, and that's 07, and how many people do you have today?
We have, I'd say around 25.
Wow. I know it varies, but about how many clients do you service any given year?
90 plus.
Wow, okay. That's a lot of clients.
Well, I mean, it's four a person.
Right.
If you think about it that way.
That's true, yeah.
You only got four clients?
Yeah.
That's it?
That's not enough. Right. Right. So, and are you...
Our team here is built differently. I mean, than I say differently. Different than other shops that I've been a part of or that I've watched. Probably after all these years of being in the business, the one thing I kind of really enjoyed focusing on was the business of lobbying.
Okay.
As opposed to the actual lobbying. After a while, you get tired of working issues or you're fascinated by something new you're learning.
Yep.
And I guess it's that fascination on how a lobbying firm worked and how to make it maximize profitability and effectiveness and how to, put that together with a bunch of type A personalities that lobbyists tend to be. And the old Washington lobbying game that was built around the star system, it was one superstar in the firm. It was a Tommy Boggs, it was a Charles Walker, it was, J.D. Williams, it was, there were stars in the industry, firms that were built around one person, the Duberstein Group.
Yep. So a star with a bunch of staff to support them.
A bunch of people that supported those people.
Okay.
Some are a little operated, they had, what I saw was that there'd be a star, the best shops were it's built on the star system, but had really high quality people inside it.
Okay.
And built it a little different. Bill Timmons is a good example of that. Duberstein's a good example of that today. Timmons back then did it. It's a different concept. So all the people I picked, to start with and that we've tried to thoughtfully grow with are people who we think have been around long enough, have held senior positions and have proven talent skills. And then they fit into the mix of what we're trying to build, which is a bipartisan firm with strong capacity in the world of tax, trade, health, now and banking, financial services. Tax, health, and financial services are the three largest practices today. And we have some other stuff, but it's mostly those areas. And to have people who've really got strong experience in those. In our business, or in our firm here, we call it the three P's of lobbying. And everybody fits into one or more of those P's. And the three P's of lobbying are understanding policy, politics, and process. And if there's a fourth P, it's personalities. Understand the personalities of the members and the Hill and how it works. But the substantive P's are where does policy and politics interact and how does it ever get done or not done if you don't like it under the process.
Okay.
And those are the skills that we have great depth in at different ways. And we combine people who have political skill or policy and political and people who have process skills. A little different.
So you, that's very interesting. So you, now like spending a lot of time on the business of lobbying.
Mm-hmm. Trying to make sure the firm grows in the right direction.
And thinking about things like that and who fits into that model.
Who's a good fit.
Yep.
You want to be very deliberative about what you're doing. terms of picking the people that...
Right. And you've probably learned a lot over the years about, you know, things to look for, or types of people not to pick.
There's certainly types of people that work and don't work, or fit and don't fit. Mm-hmm. There's certain people that are good at it, but wouldn't fit with this group.
Okay.
You got to have, you know, we're not an eat what you kill shop. We really, an eat what you kill shop simply means that you only get paid on what you bring in or what you, you know.
So you spend more time bringing stuff in and less time actually right. doing the work.
Or you don't help anybody else in the firm because you don't think you get paid on it.
Huh.
So therefore you only work on your stuff. It's true, you've only got 3 or 4 or 5 clients with my little description of it. In reality, you're helping all these other clients.
Yeah.
So while you may, if you've broken down, you know, it's not a very good measure to say if 24 or 5 people, 100 clients is 4 a piece. That's really not the way it works.
Right, because there's people who are here right. who aren't doing
there are a lot
right.
of people here who don't bring in clients.
Right.
They're working on a lot of different things because you've got people who are bringing in clients, but they've got other people working on them. And so, but everybody helps each other. We're trying to strive for a margin of profitability, not a you get X percentage of what you bring in.
Okay.
And to get that margin of profitability, you have to have a certain type of people or the cost goes up.
Hmm.
Okay? Just a fact. So it's a question of how much money you have to service clients and are willing to pay other people. Plus, you have to be bringing some value to me, and just like I bring value to you, or we start arguing about, are you going to pay me to work on that?
Right.
And that's dividing up clients instead of dividing up profits.
Okay.
Our shop is designed to divide up the profits.
And does the how you pay people, is it reflected in that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a subjective process because you're not getting a guaranteed number off of any client you bring in. But I'm not coming to you and saying, okay, Mr. O'Brien, that's a great client. I'll help you on it, but how much of that $20,000 a month retainer are you going to split with me?
Right, right.
You don't have to worry about anybody in the firm asking you that question. When you ask them, will you go set up a meeting for that client?
Right. So what is someone here, their pay, what percentage would be based on, if someone's paid, what percentage of their salary at the end of the year is from bonus or profitability? If that's one way to, if you know yeah. what I'm asking, like, right. how do you?
You know, a good chunk. I mean,
there's one firm I spoke to. It was a state firm in Connecticut, and it was they did about half and half, 50%. You got a salary, and then at the end of the year, about 50% was bonus.
No, I mean, I mean,
which would seem high to me.
Yeah, but, ours would be. Maybe when we were 4 or 5 people, it might have been that big.
Yeah, not anymore.
But we got a lot of overhead today.
But is that the way that you share? Is that the way that the...
Yeah, I mean, we set compensation, you know, pretty close to the, you know, the same for all the partners. It's not exact because you got different things. But overall, we have an average cost of partners that's sort of reflective of it. When I started the firm, I used to say, you know, the first 10,000 goes to the firm and the next 20,000 goes to you. But that was people who I needed to go create some business with, mm-hmm. you know, we were starting
yep.
something.
Yep.
So basically, I was thinking my overhead will be 1/3 and 2/3 is profit and whatever you're creating you get.
Yep.
So I still strive to this day to shoot for, you know, 60%+ going to pay people,
yep.
You know, at the partner and level, and shareholder level or better. You know, if I can get 65% and keep the overhead cost at 1/3,
yep.
That's going to beat most bigger shops.
Yep.
And to beat, you know, we're the last 3 years or so, we've been one of the top 10 revenue-producing firms in the city.
Yes.
But if you looked at the number of lobbyists we've got in relation to that revenue, we average a lot higher than most of those firms.
Hmm.
Aiken Gump may do $35 million this year. Okay. Lincoln County's got 50 lobbyists or more.
And you
registered.
Wow.
I got 20 registered on 20 million or 25. So, yeah. Patton Boggs, same thing. Any of the other firms. Large law firm, again, bodies.
Yep.
So the average, I'm not into leveraging bodies, I'm leveraging nothing. So, the average is a big difference. That which means for our guys, hey, we can compete to get the best talent because the people who can generate business and know the business will do better at Capital Counsel financially than they will anywhere else.
Right.
Unless they go on their own, and the only overhead they've got is a cell phone,
right.
You know, and their their car expense, you know, or Uber cost, you know, to go
right.
And operate out of their house, which is great. I mean, those are the most profitable firms.
but
it's not a brand that you can sell to around town as hire them because they're one of the best firms in the city.
Right. And is it hard as that person operating out of the Uber with their cell phone for the big Fortune 100 companies to hire? Are they reluctant to hire that sole person?
I think that person usually has a very unique niche skill.
Okay.
Set, and they may hire them for that.
For like a one.
But you're not going to be representing, having, it's project work.
Right. It's a one-off.
Yeah, or it's a specific, he'd be good with that member. This member's now in charge of this, and also we
got
care
it.
About that. We don't have a history over there.
Yeah.
Hire somebody who knows that office.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I'm not being critical of that.
Right, no, yeah.
Those guys probably have a higher quality of life in many respects than I do.
Right.
It's just a different
It's way. A different business.
Choosing, yeah, different business model.
Right.
What for me, it's been fun working on building a shop that had that diversity of talent, keeping that talent together, and succeeding with each other.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's interesting. It's almost like it's like new hobbies for you. Taking going from spending a lot of time on lobbying to more time actually thinking right. about running the business, thinking about the business, yeah. thinking about who.
I love a tax challenge, yeah, particularly if it's something new.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to figure out how to craft it or do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I still love working on individual client issues,
yeah.
particularly if they're like last year's bill where there was stuff that was done way too quick. 7 weeks is not good for policy, and it certainly wasn't good for the lobbying community.
Right.
to pass a bill, a tax bill, but it happened. But I still, I'll get very excited about working on a policy issue that I've worked on in the past to see if
yep.
I can keep it, keep involved.
Yeah. You must have clients that you've worked with for mm-hmm. a very long time.
Yeah. I mean, the real estate industry and I have been friends forever. And since my mother, my father died when I was like 7.
Okay.
My mother inherited a real estate business and 5 kids to raise from 17 to 7 in age.
Wow. You were the youngest?
And she had a high school education. I was the youngest. And she proved to be a very good real estate agent. And it was a profession that women could succeed in back in the 50s.
Yep.
Late 50s, early 60s.
Yep.
And she did. And so she got 5, with no college degree, she got 5 kids through college.
Wow.
And they finished up with 10 college degrees.
That's amazing.
But that also made me, as I used to often say, a real SOB, and that's the son of a broker. but you learn to sell.
Uh-huh.
You learn and building a real estate company and building a lobbying firm, not much different. You got to get people who are really good at what they do, some who know how to get listings, some who know how to sell houses, building, mix of talent,
uh-huh.
And knowing how to then market that that group to others to use it.
Uh-huh. So she had her own real estate.
She did. She ended up partnering with. She started on her own, and she partnered with Connor Patman, who was a lawyer in Texarkana, who owned a construction company and a real estate company, and wanted to do more on that side.
Hmm.
And she had become sort of the top salesperson around town. And Connor recognized that and thought, well, I own all this real estate, and I want to build houses for people. And so he said, partnered with her on the real estate side of the company.
Okay.
And so she would sell, she would build a real estate firm, and he would do law and construction, and
so you really
owned lots of real estate. My mother had nothing. With five kids.
Well, she, and she had
no assets.
But you, so you learned business, really, it's just from your mom. That's the same thing you're doing here. Wow.
Not much different. Just the, you know,
the product is different, but the
concept's the same.
Concept, relationships, and the, there may not be an answer for this, but when you look to hire people, you outlined what you look for, you know, the politics, the process, and are there things that are red flags? The reason I ask this is, you know, we'll have young people listening to this podcast who will be interested in getting into the lobbying business. And so one thing I'll ask you is what recommendation you would give to someone in college or just out of college looking to get in. Are there things that you look for or red flags that are warning signs, someone to hire or not to hire? I don't know if that's possible to answer.
You know, that for me, it's different. I mean, I could certainly say what I might tell young people, but for this firm, we're not hiring anybody who doesn't have a lot of experience. That's historically. We might have one or two people, but we don't. What you see is what you get when you interview our firm. We don't have a bunch of associates back at the office that are going to work on the client.
Okay.
The people there. So that's why I was saying our model's a little different.
Okay.
So most of the vetting process of what you do and don't do, we get to see firsthand as they work up on the Hill or in the government and see how they behave, how they operate, how they build relationships or don't. You know, how they are, they excessively partisan?
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to be a Democrat. It's okay to be a Republican. You know, in fact, everybody's one or the other pretty much, with the third, you know, a few independents around, but not in this town. There are not many independents in D.C.
No.
So, you know, you're expected to be one or the other. You know, I worked for a conservative Democrat, you know, a lot different than working for Elizabeth Warren. So Democratic Party used to be a big, you know,
yep,
tent. So we just look and see how people function and how they work. But there are certain qualities of people. If you can, you know, if you're in a, you know, just being nice to everybody is a positive. You know, there's really no reason you can't be nice. The greatest skill is when somebody has power, is to be able to say no to that, somebody that's a friend or somebody on an issue, and not and make them believe you regretted having to say no, as opposed to coming across like you enjoy saying no. I mean, there's no reason you can't say I'm sorry. That's just not something we can do without trying to be ugly. That's the stupidest idea. You know, there's people who can be confrontational. Confrontation is not what we're looking for in the lobbying business. It really is an education business. You educate the Hill about your clients' concerns, problems, how something affects them. You spend a lot of time educating your clients about why the Hill is looking at it a certain way. That is, you know, and you have to understand why that's happened. So that's why I tend to hire the most experienced people. You really have to understand how to explain what's going on up there that makes them think that's a good idea. That's a terrible idea. It may be. But they understand why they came up with that idea and what they're trying to address, and finding maybe alternative ways to address the concern is part of the business. Making them understand, the client understand, is half the battle. Now, you know, the other half maybe is educating Congress. But Congress is generally willing to listen. Staff willing to listen. If you can show them that you're going to try to help address the concern they've got, but finding a way that doesn't hurt a particular industry or business. So that's you know, we've talked about lobbying being about education. People always think, well, that's a euphemism for influence peddling. You know, it's mostly educating the clients about what you should and shouldn't ask for and why. And that's what really smart clients pay you for. They want you to explain to them, because if they thought they knew how to do it, they wouldn't need you. They'd just send a bunch of lawyers up here. Just tell people up here what they do.
Right.
So the sophisticated client gets that you need somebody who knows. You know, you don't generally hire somebody to argue before the Supreme Court who's argued before the Supreme Court before or studied it and worked on it and understands it.
Right. Right.
What's the difference between that and this?
It's interesting. Someone who worked for Senator Dodd one time asked Senator Dodd for any advice, and his advice was the same. He said, the one thing I would tell you is you can get a lot done by being polite.
Being nice to people. You don't have to, nobody said a bad word about Lloyd Benson. You know, it really is pretty rare a person who had anything negative say, even when he ran for vice president.
Yep.
Republicans were hard-pressed to say something negative about him.
Yep.
Because, you know, we had a rule in Benson's office. You had to say something nice about the person you were getting ready to oppose. And it was such a trademark of Benson's.
That was an unwritten rule that he had.
It was an unwritten rule, but it was understood. I'm not going to personally attack Jim or Joe or Bob. I want to recognize the integrity of their position or their thought on mm-hmm. this. I want to oppose the policy, and I want to lay it out in policy terms, not personal terms.
Yep.
So you didn't write anything that said the senator hasn't bothered to look at these things. You don't attack the person. You attack the idea. And that made Benson very unique in the Senate. Or not unique to then. I think that was truly like, you know, most of the members. I mean, some of them would be a little cutting and sharp. But you know, maybe it was just unique to his personality. It was so bad, though. Kennedy had an amendment on the floor of the Senate to provide a tax credit for heating fuel. Well, that's a New England problem. In Texas, more people in the country die from heat than die from cold.
Okay.
Nobody was, Senator Kennedy wasn't proposing a tax credit for air conditioning. You know?
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, you don't need to be cool, you know. But the truth is, from where we were coming from,
people were dying
from heat.
If
you were from Mission, Texas, and down in the border time, more people die from heat than die from freezing every year. So, and the reason Kennedy didn't do it is because he couldn't afford to do it for both.
Okay.
It wasn't personal. He was,
right.
But so we had written our usual opposition to just taking care of heating problems. But Benson started out praising the senator from Massachusetts for his concern and work and the like. And Senator Kennedy turned to his staffer. I was happened to be sitting behind Senator Kennedy at that time on the staff row, on staff couches, because mm-hmm. somebody else was sitting next to the senator. And Kennedy turned to his longtime he says, son of a bitch, he always has to say something nice about you before he puts a knife in. And we did then cut him up. But, you know, that was his style.
Uh-huh.
And that's missed today.
Yeah.
By some.
Yeah.
By some members.
You
know, I don't mean it all. But.
Yeah. No, it's a different atmosphere. So for someone wanting to get into the business today, I think you're going to say your advice would be to go work on campaigns, work on the Hill.
Yeah, I mean, there are different pieces to the business, policy, politics.
Yep.
Are the two, some, you know, my daughter who hated politics forever is now 25 and decides that she really, she got totally into the Hillary campaign.
Okay.
Woman running. She's very much studying, you know, her college is all about studying gender issues and that. And that just, she had met tons of politicians in her life. Been around them, you know, never interested. When she met Hillary Clinton during the 16 campaign, she just freaked. I mean, she got teary-eyed. She was so nervous. It was funny.
Hillary quite well.
Hillary and Bill Clinton are law professors at the University of Arkansas. I've known Hillary Clinton 40 years. You know? So, and she had been around all of that,
mm-hmm.
but she'd never met Hillary. I'm pretty sure she met Bill, but I mean, the idea of being around Hillary Clinton meant so much to her, and she got all enthused. So, you know, I've had her work on the political side, the fundraising side, and so forth. But I also encourage her to work up on the Hill and learn the policy side.
Yeah.
Because it's not about money. You know, you need money to run campaigns. But that's not what politics is about. You know, politics is about this integration of policy and politics.
Yep.
Where they come together.
Yep.
In politics, you need money to run campaigns, but the politics is the issues down below.
Yep.
So you got to learn those issues or learn how they fit in.
Okay.
So for her, you know, she's enjoying that. And so if I'm telling her that, I'd probably tell that to anybody else too. You know, that's what I'm recommending for my own daughter. And yep. I mean, her dream job would be to work for Emily's List or Planned Parenthood.
Yep.
She's very focused on policy.
Yep.
And she wants to change the politics in the country on those issues.
Yep.
So that's her dream world.
Okay.
And that's the daughter of a major corporation lobbyist. Right. She's not interested in working with my clients.
Right.
As
right.
much as she. So, and that's great.
Right.
You know, if she can do that, she'll have a lot of fun.
Yep.
And more power to her, you know. And so there's, I always say, you know, be nice to the people. Learn both sides of the business. There's two pieces to it. Take time if you can.
Yep.
To get a chance to work on the Hill or a chance to work in a campaign, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Get involved. You know, the other thing is, I grew up in Arkansas, Texarkana, and Texas. Arkansas people have a chip on their shoulder. They don't think they can do things as well as others. You know, there's a little bit of this inferiority complex. Texans never had that problem. So I lived in a town that has, you know, a very mixed personality. But what I learned and when I came to D.C. and working on the Hill as an intern for Mr. Patman was two things. One, just because the kid's at Harvard or other place doesn't mean he's any smarter than you or he's got an Ivy, you know, or a fancier college than you're going to. You can be going to Texarkana Community College and you're actually just as smart as that kid that's going to the end of the school. You may not realize it till you see it around you. The other thing that I learned that was really important, you got to be smart, but employers reward hard work. You can't be stupid and not be able to do the job, but if you hustle, you can take on the additional challenges or you spend the extra time and you know, the guy up above will notice, hey, that guy will take, you know, if I asked him to do it, he'll do it and he'll do it right. Now, the other guy, he thinks he's too cool to do work on that project. He doesn't need to do that. So take on every project because that will lead to the next project if you do it well.
Yep.
And just keep doing it well, and you'll find that you'll quickly, because you're not any dumber than anybody. You know, you're as capable as everybody in the room, and just accept that. Even though you grew up in some small town someplace or you didn't go to any fancy college, there's a high probability. You know, John Conley once said, 80% of corporate America is mediocre. And I think by that he just meant they don't work as hard as the others. They're all smart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a lot of truth to that. People sometimes just assume they're entitled to things and they should get them. Now, I'll say this. You give me the kid who went to Harvard and bust his butt, you probably get a Supreme Court spot, but you'll get something.
So hard work can make up for it.
Hard work can make up for a lot of things. It's real simple. Willingness to take on anything.
Okay.
You know, I don't do that. That's not, it's not important enough. That can get you, you know.
That hard work can get you ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, John, thank you very much.
Sure.
We appreciate it. This has been great. Really great.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the show. Great interview. Great guy, John Raffaele. Check us out on Twitter. And if you haven't already, subscribe to the show and leave some comments if you want. Have a great week and see you next Monday.